Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this Sunday evening, and it's time for a rude awakening, but one of the very, very best kind, a kind that has entertained New York theatergoers for 25 years. It is the silver anniversary, ladies and gentlemen, of Forbidden Broadway. Now, if you've never seen Forbidden Broadway, what the hell is wrong with you? Folks, this review that pokes fun, that tickles the ribs of every show on Broadway, well, not every show, but most of the shows on Broadway, has been around longer than Spam-A-Lot, longer than Broadway Cares benefits that took their cue from what Forbidden Broadway does, which is just make fun in song of shows old and new, the performers, the legends of Broadway, and really, gut them a little bit with a knife, but still with so much love for Broadway and theater that you can't help but walk out of there smiling and humming and just thrilled to be part of the theater community. Now, the person who invented, created, and continues to write and direct Forbidden Broadway is Gerard Alessandrini, and believe it or not, he's in the neighborhood with us tonight. Gerard Alessandrini, welcome to the neighborhood.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here tonight.
All I can say is, first of all, before anything else, thank you so much. I mean, I remember being taken when I was in my teens, must have been in my, well, maybe early 20s, when it was still at Paulson's.
Yes.
And where you guys started. But why don't you give the basic overview of how the show started with a budget of about $5 and just an idea and a piano.
Right. It's true. You can do a show if you just do it. That's, you've seen it in old Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movies, and it does happen occasionally. Not often, but 25 years ago, I wanted to showcase myself as a performer and friends of mine that were very talented, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to take the songs from the actual Broadway shows and write parody lyrics or change the lyrics to actually make fun of them? Of course, you know, writing parody lyrics to existing songs is nothing new. That's probably as old as theater itself.
Sure.
But I guess the little different angle was we were using the songs from Annie make fun of Annie, or the songs from Fiddle on the Roof to make fun of Fiddle on the Roof. So it was like you would sing a sort of a skewed version of the real shows.
I think
there were plenty of stars then. And, you know, we started it in a supper club with just the costumes from our closet, and we did it, and it pretty quickly caught on, and a lot of celebrities started coming in the press game. And before we know it, we had a little hit show.
A little hit show that ran, and then how often do you update? Is it every single year or season that you update it, or maybe every 2 years?
Yes, about every year and a half I do a complete updating. In other words, we retitle the show, and I write all new numbers, and mostly new numbers, about 80% new numbers, and sort of give it a different slant or some kind of funny slant. This year, Rude Awakening, of course, that's taking its cue from Spring Awakening, which is a huge critical hit and is just starting to become popular with the public. And, of course, I don't do just Spring Awakening. We do everything, but it's sort of a jump-off point. But even though I update it and do a new edition about every year and a half, I really put new numbers in, every few weeks. We put a new number. As a show will close or a new show will come up, like we already have some new shows coming up this season,
right.
Young Frankenstein, and there's also The Ritz and some other. I'm sure we'll want to parody those shows in the next few weeks or so as people begin to see them.
Are you going to do Putting on the Ritz? Is that going to...
Oh, maybe. Well, that's a song certainly everybody knows from it, but who knows? By the time it opens up, maybe there'll be another standout song, of course.
Hmm.
The score by Mel Brooks, who also wrote The Producer, so there could be some very interesting material in there.
Do you ever feel pressured to come up with a song for a show that has to be covered because it's so major to the season and you're just racking your brains and it's like...
Oh, that's absolutely true. It's hard. You know, sometimes you get a big hit show, and it's not really well-known by the public, and it's hard to, until it becomes the talk of the town, it's hard to find an angle. And then, of course, you just can't take a song from a show or that show. You have to be funny, too. So I have to come up with a funny idea to take on it. And, yeah, sometimes it's very hard. I remember when we were spoofing Chicago, the show which is, you know, the revival has been running over 10 years now. And everybody sort of knew the theater songs. They had been around for generations. But it took me three or four numbers before we settled on one or two that were very funny, you know. And finally I used Give Me Old Razzle Dazzle and changed it to Give Me Old Glossy Fossy about how they sort of stole Bob Fosse's concepts in this version. So, and that worked. And, of course, now we spoof all the stars that come in. But sometimes it takes a few go-rounds or, you know, shooting of the arrows before I hit the bullseye.
Do you test the songs? Obviously, on audiences, you slip a new song in every few weeks, too, and then it gets tested before it might go into the next full-season edition.
Yes.
But is there a quality control in between when you've finally written it out and when it goes out there? Are there certain people that you really trust and you go, can you give this a listen?
Well, I trust the performers, and, you know, and I co-direct the show with the very talented Mr. Philip George,
mm-hmm.
and he puts his two cents in. He's wonderful at doing the staging. Like when we do the turntable and the Miz. But, you know, I ask his opinion, and I run it by the cast, and, the barometer is doesn't make us laugh. If it just sits there and nobody laughs, then let's not do it.
Mm.
If it's making us laugh, let's try it. And then the true barometer after we've assembled it is the audience, and they'll tell us, you know. And sometimes we think a song is going to be funny or make a point, and we put it in front of an audience, and it lays there. Like a dead squirrel or something, you know.
Right.
And sometimes the reverse. Sometimes we think we have something decent, and then we put it in the audience howls. We've struck a nerve.
It lies there like the Pirate Queen.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, we can't really spoof flop shows like the Pirate Queen because not a lot of people have seen them. You can mention them. You can maybe throw a little thing in. But we have to spoof shows that everybody has seen. I think that's one of the reasons why Spin Brody has played for so many years, because we're not really, I mean, we're somewhat being inside, but I'm careful about it. I really want to spoof the shows that everybody sees and knows and loves.
Yeah, I was a little surprised in this edition you took on Coast of Utopia, which was a hit, but obviously in a very kind of minor New York way.
Yeah, sort of an elite hit. It was a wonderful production. Well, you know, it was around for about 9 months, and of course, if you notice how much time we spent on it, I only spent like a minute and a half on it.
Right.
You know, which is sort of in relation to where it comes in as in relation to how many people have seen the show. And, of course, I use it, and this is the fun part about Spin Board, I use it in a Grease number. So, you know, I can mix shows together the way they're not really mixed. Or even stars, the way I put Ethel Merman with the Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if you're not old enough to have a handle on who Ethel Merman is, you'll certainly get the Phantom of the Opera spoof. And then we try to keep it self-explanatory. But I have to be careful. Sometimes, you know, people haven't seen the shows. Or if a show closes and disappears, it becomes less funny as the weeks go by. So we pull it and we put a new number in or something new. So the show is always changing. And then about a year and a half, we do a complete revamp.
Right.
And that's what we've just done. We have a new version of the show.
Okay, listen to me. No, I mean listen to me on Compact Disc, where bunches of past episodes of Dave's Gone By are yours to hear over and over again. Comedy sketches like Mel's A-Poppin' and Handyman Yoni, visits with guests like Reckless Eric and Julie Haggerty, punchlines and politics in the News Gone By, all just $11 a disc, shipping included. Visit davesgoneby.org or call 516-295-1511 for me on CD. We're talking with Gerard Alessandrini, the creator, the brains and the brawn behind Forbidden Broadway, which, by the way, is playing at the 47th Street Theater, which I think is your third official venue.
Oh, it's our sixth official venue.
Oh, really? Well, there was Paulson's, and then there was...
Well, we've been around a long time. Sometimes we outlast the buildings, you know.
we were
at Paulson's on 72nd Street, and then we were at Theater East
mm-hmm.
on the east side for a number of years, which I believe is now defunct. And then we were back at Paulson's, but it's not Paulson's now. It's called the Triad.
Oh, that's Triad, okay.
It's a lovely cabaret theater. We were there for less than a year.
Hmm.
And then we moved to the Stardust Diner.
Right.
Diner, my Boston accent showing, on Broadway and 50th Street. And then they closed that, but our show didn't close. And then we moved to the Douglas Fairbanks Theater on 42nd Street. This is probably too much information for you.
Well,
and they tore that down. So,
man.
So actually that was, we felt bad about that because that was a good home. But it was fortuitous because now the 47th Street Theater is actually the best location and theater we've been in New York, and
that
it's the most
enjoyable
to see the show.
That was the question I was going to ask you, because of some of the venues that you had been in before were cabaret-ish bar clubs. People could drink, they could have a little a nosh while they were, it had
yes.
more of a cabaret-ish feel. Now you're in a theater-type off-Broadway theater. And I was wondering if you thought the show gained or lost by being in that.
Well, it both lost and gained something. It lost the party feel that it had. You know, we were still doing it in cabaret settings in New York for many years, and yet outside of New York, when we would present it, for example, in Boston, Los Angeles, we would do it in a small theater. But in New York, I tried to keep it a cabaret, sort of, that was part of the concept of the show, that it was underground, that it was slightly naughty, that you could be drunk while you were seeing the show. So it lost that party feel, but what it's gained is you can really see and hear it now very clearly. You can see all the costumes.
It's
true. Hear all the lyrics.
Yeah.
Actually, there's more laughter, you know, there's more of a response from the audience because they're paying closer attention. So that's the upside. And, of course, being the writer, I kind of enjoy that.
You don't have to hear the waitress trying to take a drink order you're doing a song. Absolutely. One of the scenes that you do that I found a little bit surprising in this edition, the Forbidden Broadway Rude Awakening, was about Spamalot. Because, A, it involves the question of already trying to do a spoof of a spoof of a comedy. I mean, it's gone beyond even just spoofing a musical comedy, which you've always been doing. But here is a musical comedy that already is laughing at itself, and you're trying to laugh at it. And I want to ask if that presented a particular problem, and of course you answer that in the song that you do about Spamalot. And then I also wonder what your feelings are about this mega theater joking about itself that's happening more and more in what we call regular theater.
Right. Well, in Spamalot, which I actually enjoyed quite a bit because I love comedy. I love to be made to laugh. There were moments that you thought, well, this is right out of Forbidden Broadway. So we had a comment on that. And it is hard to spoof a spoof. So in a way, I'm lucky that they gave me that ammunition. Of course, when I saw Spamalot, I thought, you know, they stole more from Mel Brooks than they stole from me. They had more elements of the producers in it. But, yes, nowadays the trend is towards what I've been told is called the meta-musical, which is a musical that refers to itself as a musical and makes fun of itself or is ironic. And there's a lot of them. There's not only is there Spamalot and the Mel Brooks shows, like the producers of Young Frankenstein, but there's The Drowsy Chaperone.
Right.
Does it in a big way.
And off-Broadway, there was Title of Show. There was a spate of off-Broadway
ones. Oh, yeah. Oh, there's so many also. I mean, even to an extent, if you saw The Wedding Singer last year, even or Legally Blonde, they do it in part. Or Year in Town did it, like all of
certainly Year in Town, yeah.
As a musical, go into a sort of West Side Story type number that makes you laugh at West Side Story. So it's been happening a lot in shows. I'm a little disconcerted by it, not because it cuts into my territory, because it actually makes Forbidden Broadway more popular or more mainstream, but because it's too bad. It's almost like the writers really can't write the real thing sometimes, you know, a real three-dimensional musical with characters that you believe. So it's sort of an easy way out to be self-referential or say, hey, folks, we're doing a musical comedy, yuck, 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 you know.
That's an interesting point. Since you're mentioning all these other musicals, I'm kind of wondering what were some of your favorite musicals of the last 10 years?
Well, it's surprising. I like, since I do a musical review, I tend to like things that are not what I do. So I like musicals, like I said, where the characters are three-dimensional, that are musical plays. So, I enjoy a lot of the Sondheim shows when they're revived.
Well, sure.
You can still take the characters seriously, like Bobby and Company. And I love Ragtime. I've enjoyed some of the Disney ones. I'm not a big fan of them because they can be self-referential, too. I think of all the Disney ones, I enjoyed Beauty and the Beast the most because it was more like a classic musical, and at the time, they made you take it seriously. I very much liked Light in the Piazza. I thought he did that correctly. You see, part of the reason that a musical works is because it's funny when people burst into song. So every time you write a musical, if you want people to take it seriously, you have to figure out a new way for them to burst into song that won't make the audience laugh.
Right.
Basically, that's what they did in Light in the Piazza. It was sort of a subtler new way of getting into the music, in and out of the music. And, of course, it was very much like you took a trip to Italy and went into these characters. So I liked that very much. I liked Spelling Bee, I liked very much, William Finn's show. I thought that was very funny, and I was very much with the characters.
I'll go with you on that. But my other problem, certainly with Light in the Piazza and even with Spelling Bee, is the score didn't really do it for me, as it were. I didn't, don't particularly want to listen to the cast albums.
Yeah, there is that element, like, you know, how, I mean, the musicals from the Golden Age, like the Lennon Lowe musicals and the Roger Hamilton musicals, you know, you could extrapolate the songs, and but they were musical plays. But, and it's true, you may not want to sit and listen to those cast albums while you're having dinner or something, but they're really wonderful musical plays, you know?
Mm.
And as a theater experience, even though the music can't be extrapolated like some of the older musicals, they all works into a very charming evening of theater. So you're still moved by them. You may not go out humming 16 bars, but...
Or it doesn't give you the opportunity to take a song like Hello Dolly or whatever it is, Bali High, and then use that melody time after time to do different parodies because nobody's going to know them.
Not necessarily true. You can do it with songs that are... I mean, songs are... they stick out in a different way nowadays than Hello Dolly, you know, which is very... goes right to the heart. It's sort of very exciting and simplistic and... Oh, not simplistic is a word, but, you know, they're...
Like before the parade passes by also.
Right.
I mean, a Jerry Herman tune.
There are certainly songs that, like Light in the Piazza, the opening number, had that idea of her reading from a tour book, and we were able to do that. Or Les Miserables is a good example. I mean, in many ways, Les Miserables is like an opera, you know.
Right.
But
that will have a couple of songs. I'm not talking about while the show is still resonant in memory.
Yeah.
I'm talking about taking a show that has been gone for 10 or 15 years, and then... being able to use that number because it has seeped into the consciousness.
All right. Well, once the old musical comedy numbers used to actually go into the cultural subconscious. So, you know, the sound of music in Hello Dolly, yeah.
You can do that with a couple of, obviously, the Andrew Lloyd Webber sort of songs, and you can do that here and there, maybe with a song from, like, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels or something, but not, I don't know, about some of the other shows that we've been talking about. That's what I'm really getting at.
Well, I just think it's time and repetition that makes the song part of the culture. It's not necessarily whether the song in itself is that. It's, you know, the Disney things like Beauty and the Beast, The Little Mermaid, they're around so much, and you know when they first put those movies out or first put out some of those musicals, they were new music. People didn't necessarily know them right away. It's just that after, you know, 20 years of hearing it. I mean, Sondheim is a good example of that.
Mm.
I mean, people criticized his shows in the 70s for not being melodic because the music wasn't as easily accessible as Jerry Herman because it was denser. And now, you know, you go see Company and you go see Follies and it's loaded.
Right, of course.
As many hit songs as a Jerry Herman show. People know them and they hum along. And it's hard to believe that at one time people thought the music was inaccessible. It just takes time and repetition for that.
But that also leads to, I don't know if it's more of a comment or a question, but I do have this feeling also that, conversely to really what I've just been saying over the past 5 minutes, if you were to take the best two or three songs from shows like even Legally Blonde, High Fidelity, Marie Christine, all the Wild Horn shows, and you like gave them to American Idol people to sing, you know, I think, A, we might see our newer musicals in a better and a different light, and B, we might have hit songs out of shows. They're just not getting a chance because the critics are going, and the audiences aren't coming.
Right.
And meanwhile, there are songs tucked in there all the way through in what we consider more minor musicals or far from masterpieces. Do you agree with that, or am I just kind of hopefully reaching?
Well, certainly, the musicals that you listed, Legally Blonde, The Wedding Singer, Mary Christine, I mean, they didn't have any songs that leapt out and became popular. I was trying to think what's the last big song that became popular from a new Broadway show. I mean, the trend nowadays is to do the reverse, take a group of popular songs and make them into a musical.
Well, that was the Wild Horn trend. That was what he tried, and that didn't really work.
If I could think a minute, I could probably give you an example of... I mean, it does happen. It just doesn't happen from those musicals. You know? I'm trying to think if the producer, anything stood out from the producers. Well, actually, it did for Theater People. Or Marvin Hamill's show or something. I don't know. It does happen. It just doesn't happen as much as it used to. I mean, in the 50s and 60s, Broadway shows were designed to be popular music, and popular music was looking for Broadway for these songs. Now, that onus isn't on a show anymore, so what's important is it a good piece of musical theater? Is it a good musical play?
Speaking of good musical plays, a lot of the alumni alumnuses.
Yes.
I've got to work on that. Your show, Of Forbidden Broadway, have gone on to some renown in the actual legit world and other places.
Yes.
Well, I can name a few. You can name a few. I mean, a lot of women have actually come out of Forbidden Broadway and moved forward. Well, not that Forbidden Broadway is a backward thing, but
right.
Barbara Walsh.
Barbara Walsh, who recently did the revival of Company. I mean, Dee Hody has gotten several Tony nominations. She was in Forbidden Broadway. A lot of them are well-known on Broadway, in the Broadway community. In the original cast was Chloe Webb, a good friend of mine.
Chloe Webb, wow.
She hasn't done anything really big lately, but she was on the show years ago, China Beach, and she was in Tales of the City, and she made a couple of big movies like Love Affair and Sid and Nancy. So she was fairly well-known in the film and television industry. I mean, probably the most famous person came out of Broadway was Jason Alexander, who, of course, was on Seinfeld. Most of the Broadway shows that are running now feature or star people that have been in Broadway. For example, Daniel Reichert is starring in Jersey Boys, is one of the Jersey Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in Spin Broadway. So most of the major talents of Broadway work all the time in theater, if not in film and television.
Well, we're talking with Gerard Alessandrini of Forbidden Broadway, the creator, the director, he's co-director, so he's the almost everything behind this wonderful 25-year-old show. If you have another couple of minutes, I do have another couple of questions for you.
Sure.
About really the theme of the current Forbidden Broadway, and we've been circling around it, actually, is you're taking pot shots a lot at musicals that are so far out of the old school, mainly because they're filled with pop songs or that they're revivals, but you've been making fun of that forever. But in this particular case, it really felt again and again, and some of the critics who were a little negative about this edition of Forbidden Broadway say that has affected your ability to be funny because what you're criticizing isn't even worth, on some level, hitting the heights of criticism. Because, you're criticizing something like Grease or the score of Jersey Boys, which is a bunch of pop songs. Am I getting something with this?
Yeah, I think you are. I mean, it's a good point. I mean, as Broadway changes, so does Forbidden Broadway, because it reflects it. There are a lot of jukebox musicals where we call those jukebox musicals. They're musicals where you take a group of songs that are connected for some reason either from the composer or the star, and then you build a show around them. That would be Jersey Boys, Mamma Mia. Various shows like that. So, they tend not to be as cohesive as a more well-written piece of musical theater because, they have to move things around. They can't tell the story in a linear way or something.
But Jersey Boys is about the book. It's a great book. But
what, Jersey Boys?
Yeah. It's a really true. I think it's a very
okay. I mean, yeah, I actually had issues with it.
The songs are
enjoyable enough. I had issues because a lot of it is narrated, and to me that wasn't as dramatic as watching the parts where you could watch the scenes played out.
But as an audience member of Forbidden Broadway Rude Awakening, I know that when I sit there and you make fun of last season's revival of Company, where all the actors were playing their own instruments, or you're making fun of some of the other shows, and you start playing some of the Sondheim or the Jerry Herman music, or even the music from Grey Gardens, and you get a frisson, a little chill, and because as theatergoers, we're connected to this music, we're emotionally, there's something that happens to us when we hear it, and yet when you start playing or making fun of We Go Together from Grease, or you get the Jersey Boys thing, and the courts start playing for Walk Like a Man. It's not the same. I'm no offense
no,
to you,
no,
but it's
it
not
is,
the
it
same.
Not because it's lesser music, just because it's not written as theater music. It's written to be played on the radio, which is fine, which is great. But, sitting in the theater watching somebody sing, it takes a particular type of music and to be really exciting.
Right.
The same way, as we talked about, some theater music does not translate well to a CD or the radio.
Have you ever tried writing pop music or for other
pop, I'm
idioms?
I'm not interested in pop. I have some classical training. I've tried writing theater music. I have a lot of original material I have that I pull out once in a while, and I'm working on an original theatrical project now. I wouldn't call it pop music, but it's called theater music. They both have their... the problem with using pop music in a show is the music itself is wonderful, very entertaining, very accessible. but does it fit into an evening story? And if you can do it, if you can make it work, like Mamma Mia or Jersey Boys, you can make a lot of money, you know.
Right.
Or you can end up with something like John Lennon, the musical from 2 years ago.
Now, I kind of like that one. See,
that one?
I like more than Mamma Mia, because I like musical more than, well, a lot of different reasons.
Yeah.
No, by the way, I know I sound like such a theater snob. I'm totally into rock and roll and all of that, so I didn't want to give that impression either.
Yeah,
but,
well, rock and roll's great. It's great music. It's just... doesn't always fit into theater. I mean, the Billy Joel show that they did 2 seasons ago, Moving Out, I thought that was a great usage of pop music.
Well, it was a dance musical. It helped, yeah.
Blending dance and the music and being faithful to the music. That was very exciting. That made it work. But it fails a lot. They had that Beach Boy musical.
Oh, God.
You know, you can't always translate it into a theater piece.
Right. Well, Bad Vibrations for that one.
We
remember that. Well, now I am intrigued. You say you're writing a theater piece. Have you written "quote unquote" legitimate musicals? Are they in your drawer, or were they done regionally or something?
I have some that were done regionally, and I have a couple in my drawer and a couple that I'm working on that hopefully I'll have a reading of the next year. I do. Vin Bardi is my main income, so I keep working on that. And as I said, you know, we like to keep it fresh. We like to update it, you know, from month to month. So, you know, we're always in there rehearsing new numbers.
Do you ever...
That takes the front burner. But, yes, I have attempted to do the other thing. And but if I'm going to do it, I have to do it well, you know.
And the other question that I'm kind of curious about is when you're writing parodies and spoofs, do you ever let your comic instincts go against your real feelings about the show? Like, if you really like a show, but you have to parody it...
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, it's actually easier and more fun to make fun of a show if I like it, because it's more fun to play with the score and to make fun of it. So, for example, I actually really have an admiration and have enjoyed the show Les Miserables, but it's tremendous fun to make fun of.
True.
And sometimes people say, like, oh, I see that you hated Les Mis as much as I do. And I want to say, well, I say to myself, well, no, I actually liked it. You know,
well,
it doesn't mean I'm not going to say something. You can't find something catty to say about it, because that's the fun thing to do.
No, but something like, I think the only time that my hackles were raised a little bit in this edition of Forbidden Broadway was for David Hyde Pearson Curtains. And I think you kind of go after him a little bit. And was that a... Now, I'm wondering, do you feel that way? Do you feel like he's the bus and truck journeyman... you know, tired businessman star? Or did you just sort of think you just had to make fun of something and he seemed to be the target there?
I think the second. I think, right. I think I may have actually admired him more in the show than we let on in Spin Broadway. But it's sort of fun to look at it in that way, to put that slant on it. Of course, he's kind of doing the same thing himself in the show. We're sort of stealing their comedy. He sort of plays the I really can't sing and dance aspect. And, yeah, it was a quite a star performance, and I was impressed.
Okay.
But, but it's fun to take the devil's advocate and look the other way and say, like, well, you know, he's a TV star on Broadway. How can we make fun of that?
Mm, right. No, because as opposed to, say, what you do with Raul Esparza in Company, where you make fun of Raul being very, very intense. And you can say that, and it's still sort of a compliment, even though you're making fun of just that, like, relentless intensity of his.
Right. Well, of course, you know, when I wrote this, by this time David Hyde Pearson won the Tony, so you can knock somebody when they're up, you know.
Good point.
It's easier to do that. Hi, I'm Gerard Alessandrini, the writer-director of Forbidden Broadway, and you are listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
By the way, I've never even really got into, as we're closing out this interview with Gerard Alessandrini, how old are you?
I'm 51.
51. So you've got I assume you foresee continuing this for 20, 30-odd more years? The odder the better?
Oh, I don't know. Let's just say season to season, you know.
Really? Okay.
This edition's been very successful, so I'm sure we'll be doing this for about a year and a half, 2 years more. We'll let this edition run its course and add some new things to it. So for the next, for the foreseeable future, we'll keep it going.
Hmm.
But, you know, I enjoy doing it very much. As long as it continues to be enjoyable and as long as there's a Broadway and people want to see Forbidden Broadway, we'll do it. But if there comes a time where I feel that I've had enough or there's not as much on Broadway to do, I might let it go. I mean, you know, it's not really one show that's run 25 years. It's really a series of shows. So it is possible we could, you know, not do it for a couple of years and bring it back. But, you know, right now it's sort of year to year.
Well, I'm hoping it will stay because, to me, this season, certainly, I considered it the beginning of my season going to theater. I mean, I saw a couple of shows over the summer and stuff, but when I sat there for the opening night of Forbidden Broadway, Rude Awakening, I just felt, aha, this is where I ought to be. These are my people. This is what we should be doing. We're enjoying ourselves. We're having a wonderful time. We're making fun, but we're also embracing. And I think New York Theater would be a much poorer place without Forbidden Broadway and without you, honestly.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you said that. I really appreciate that, and I feel that, too.
So, I'm glad you feel that, too. That's great.
Yeah, no, I like that Forbidden Broadway is part of the theater community of New York, you know. And most of the stars and people in the shows come to see the show at some point or other.
Well, yeah, Chita Rivera was there on the night that I...
Ashley Brown from Mary Poppins was there.
Who are some of the most famous folks over the years? Who have...
Well, early on, I mean, if you go back, if you know your musical theater history, if you can remember Mary Martin and Ethel Merman,
mm-hmm.
and Carol Channing, they all came to see the show.
Wow.
George Burns, I remember Cher came once, Christopher Reeve when he was still alive, Elizabeth Taylor. Most of the writers come every year, like Stephen Sondheim comes once every year.
Oh.
Hal Prince, Jerry Herman has frequented the show. So a lot of those, and then a lot of the young writers like Jeff Marks and Avenue Q, you know, they come. Marvin Hamlisch, who are some of the stars. Bernadette Peters, Patti LuPone has come frequently. I think Patti LuPone's great. She's one of my favorite talents. But I think I get a feeling she comes not only to laugh but also to check up on what we're saying about her.
Well, I'm sure they all have a little kind of. So do they give you feedback, or do they just say wonderful, wonderful, we love it, or?
No, most of them give me feedback. Nobody, none of those stars I've ever mentioned have said anything particularly negative. Sometimes they'll say things like, oh, I like the solo numbers a lot, or I like this one was more fun than the last one you did, or, you know, something like that. Sometimes I'll actually get some comments like, oh, you should move this number to the first act and that one to the second.
Hmm.
You know, they're very much entertain a dialogue with us. They'll talk to the actors, you know.
And have you ever had someone who was actually offended by...
You know, nobody has ever said anything to my face or sent me a letter, but I assume we might have offended some people. I mean, people, you know, can be sensitive. But nobody has ever actually said anything to our face. I think that as fun and as naughty as Forbidden Broadway can be, I think we're not as mean as a lot of the critics. So I think if they're in theater and they can take that, they can take Forbidden Broadway. And, of course, like I said, we don't really spoof the flops or the flop stars. We're really spoofing the big icons of theater. So Raul Esparza came to see the show. So, you know, he noted that he was in the company of all these huge classic stars. So it actually was sort of a compliment.
Good. I mean, that's the spirit of it. Yeah. And that's absolutely that's true. So, again, I hope is that you find the material and the impetus and the energy to keep doing it, not just for another year or another year and a half, but, I don't know, another century of Forbidden Broadway I think would be pretty cool.
Well, you know, theater is endless, and after I'm done with Forbidden Broadway,
uh-huh.
finished writing Forbidden Broadway, I'm so sure some young person, industrious person, will come up and write something like Forbidden Broadway that does the same thing. And I hope they do.
Do you go to the, what do you call it, the Broadway Easter...
The Easter Bonnet competition, right?
Right, and the other one, the...
Yeah, the actors themselves write those numbers, not the writers.
Do you visit? Do you have you ever checked them out?
I do. What they can do that Forbidden Broadway can't do is they can do things on large scale. Like, they can get 40 people to do a number, you know, and make fun of a choral piece or put elements together of costumes and actors that we can't do because we have to reduce everything to the miniature version that's been brought in, is the four people on the piano,
right.
Which in itself is fun. But so it's in some way a different type of satire, which is fine. But I certainly have enjoyed it and laughed at it.
Good, yeah. And by the way, for people who we'll tell them one more time that Forbidden Broadway, to laugh at that, and especially at their new edition, Rude Awakening, please go to the 47th Street Theater, very convenient, right in the Times Square area. And, you know, all I can say, highly recommend it, and not just because I'm kissing my guests rear end, Gerard Alessandrini, who I thank so much for being in the Daverhood.
Well, thank you, Dave. Thank you.